We have a large number of interested individuals from different interest groups, Tendermere, that are with us this morning. We want to welcome all of you. We particularly want to isolate a few people that are trying to, they are going to help us to make sure that we deal responsibly with the expropriation bill that is before us. We'll start off by extending our appreciation to the Deputy Minister for being here with us this morning. I'm also reliably informed that the Minister for the Honourable Tulat Nyesi will join us as we proceed with the deliberations of the day. With the Minister and Deputy Minister, we also welcome the colleagues from the Department of Public Works. We appreciate the assistance that you're going to provide to us today. We also want to welcome the representative from the Northwest Province, the Honourable Motabane. We appreciate the interest of the Northwest in the deliberations. We want to welcome the people from Parliament, particularly the Parliamentary Advisor, Mr. Tawazi, and also a representative from the State Law Advisor, Mr. Nguyen. We look forward to walking with you this long part on the Section 76 bill, which requires us constitutionally to follow particular processes, and the consultation with the provinces is going to be key in this processing of the bill, and we appreciate that we can depend on your cooperation from the institutions of this Parliament to accompany us. We also want to welcome the members of the media that are here with us. We want to welcome our normal participants, the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. If there are any other similar civil society units that are here with us today, we want you to know that we appreciate your presence. We appreciate the work that our staff has done for us, our support staff in the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development, in the preparations for this meeting. We have received most of our documents in time, other than the minutes, and we'll deal with the minutes later on. We want to then finally say to members of this Select Committee that we appreciate your attendance in the meeting today. Oh, I've just been informed that the chairperson of the Free State Legislature is also here. I did not see. You've been here when we walked in. I thought you're part of the Department of Public Works team. Sorry, madam. You are very, very welcome. I know you have been here very happy and giving us your bistro. So we have two of the provinces represented here. In all then, I must just say that we have here with us today myself from Gauteng, we have the Free State, we have Limpopo, we have Northwest, we have Western Cape, we have Northern Cape, and we have Eastern Cape represented here. Now my mathematics is not that good, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the provinces. We have an apology from our chief whip because he's dealing with some matters related to taking parliament to the people in Mpumalanga, and Honorable Mtinguye has rendered an apology, and we also have an apology from the Honorable Leader. Can the Secretary just help me to make sure that I didn't skip anybody in the welcome and introduction? We've covered it all. Thank you very much. Our agenda, Honourable Members, for today is to receive a briefing from the Department of Public Works on the Expropriation Bill, B4B 2015, and this is a Section 76 bill, which constitutionally requires that there be consultation with the provincial legislatures before the finalization of the bill. I will then immediately give over in terms of the agenda. We've done the apologies, we've done the welcoming, we've done the briefing element. I will just, before we disperse, request that those that have to leave us after the presentation do so quietly. Everybody is welcome to sit with us as we deal with the last item on the agenda, which is just going to be the announcements. Normally that takes about 2-3 minutes. Can I then immediately hand over to Minister Gentleman to lead the delegation from the Department of Public Works in the presentation to us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and it's a good morning to all colleagues, those who are parliamentarians, but also other colleagues as well. Let me just briefly introduce the two key colleagues from the department, Manisa Fakela Lindi, who is the DDE for policy, and Andre Meyrink, who is the chief director. And Andre in particular has been busy in this piece of legislation for longer than any of us would want to imagine. While we're trying to pull up the PowerPoint, let me just give a brief background. I think it might be useful for all of us just to remind ourselves about it. So in 1996, with the passing of the Constitution, and particular the Bill of Rights, Clause 25, which is our key reference point in this expropriation bill process. Clause 25, which is often called the Property Clause, talks about expropriation, and we'll refer to the specific things that it says as we proceed in the presentation. But amongst other things, it says that expropriation, either for a public purpose or in the public interest, must occur where appropriate, but any appropriation, any deprivation of property cannot be arbitrary. There must be a clear process followed, and any appropriation must have some compensation. And then it said that any appropriation process must be guided by general law of application. And I think it wisely said that because, also just a reminder of this, that as we speak, there is an existing apartheid-era law, the 1975 Expropriation Act, which is still on the books, but is unconstitutional in a number of ways, and we'll speak to that. But also a whole range of different pieces of legislation empower all provinces, including the Western Cape, the Premier of the Western Cape, to expropriate. All municipalities have expropriating powers, including those run by ANC, DA, and many others. Currently have expropriating powers. Several national ministers and a president all have expropriating powers in terms of different pieces of legislation. What has been missing is exactly what the Bill of Rights calls for, which is a general law describing what would be a constitutionally compliant approach, whether it's the Minister of Land Reform, whether it's the Premier of the Free State, whether it's this or that national minister expropriating in terms of different pieces of legislation. What has been missing is a clear guide which would indicate how to comply constitutionally with expropriation. And this has resulted in numbers of problems. So in the course of the parliamentary, the National Assembly Portfolio Committee hearings, for instance, we heard from ESCOM. ESCOM said that often they would be trying to build transmission lines to get to rural areas, and they go from point A to point M, and they go from Z to point O, and then somewhere in between, a couple of landowners hold up. And obviously trying to drive up the price. Now, construction teams and so on are kept in abeyance, and electricity is not getting to where we need it to get, and so forth. And so there's a speculative attempt. And of course, ESCOM and government have often been uncertain about the appropriation. Not that we've got powers, because clearly we do, but how to proceed and how not to fall foul of constitutional court challenges. There's been a reluctance sometimes. So there's been either massive delays in key projects, or we've seen exorbitant amounts of money paid just so that the thing can go on. So this bill is trying to fulfill the Bill of Rights injunction that there should be a law that governs, in general terms, okay, the application of any expropriation. So, after many years, because we, as legislators, as people involved in legislating, we have failed, often more than 20 years now, but collectively between the NA and the NCO, to put in place what is required constitutionally, this law of general application. In 2008, there was an attempt to introduce an expropriation bill, and it got withdrawn. In my view, it was correctly withdrawn, because it tried to get around, it tried to basically make it impossible for there to be a court appeal about compensation. And in my amateurish reading of the Constitution of the Right to Compensation, you can't prevent people, can't prevent access to courts on anything for that matter, but not least on, amongst other things, on the compensation issue. So it was withdrawn in 2008 and didn't get into Parliament. With Minister Gillespie back in the previous administration coming in as Minister, we then revised the bill, okay, and then tried to correct what were the shortcomings. So we missed the deadline in the last administration of the last Parliament in getting it through, but we went to NEDLAC, and so we spent a lot of time with basically the earliest form of the bill consulting with the NEDLAC partners, and I'm pleased to say that it was eventually support. Obviously, the Banking Council, Agri-SA, COSATU, had slightly different shades of emphasis and would prefer this to be changed or that to be changed. But NEDLAC, as a totality, there was no disagreement upon which they all agreed. There was no common agreement, and they signed off on the early version of the bill in front of us. So that was an important process. It was frustrating because it took a long time as we went back and forth, but it was well done. Amongst others, Agri-SA were active participants in that process and so forth. So we then brought it back to Parliament finally in 2015, essentially, the last year. And the portfolio committee started in February with the bill, and then actively from about September, actively engaged clause by clause after having very extensive public hearings. And I'm pleased to say that obviously in the National Assembly we all then as different political parties posture inevitably in the theatre of national but in the committee we worked extremely well, and there was effective support and constructive contribution from all the political parties, with one possible exception, and I don't think exception is present there, you can guess, but even there was not disruption of the process. Okay. So that's where we are today. So on Tuesday, National Assembly with 203 votes passed the thing. There were the DAA sought to introduce a couple of last minute amendments, which in my view were obviously wrong, but were not substantive. And there's no allegation that what we've got from the side of the DAA, this is unconstitutional. There was a difference to change this or that. That's my version, but obviously the DAA colleagues will consult with their colleagues and that's actually and Christy. So if against the background, if we could then proceed with the presentation of the bill as it has come through from the National Assembly. So let's move to the first slide. Okay. We've got it on screen, but it's not coming up on.
I can see it on my screen.
Up there it's not. I mean, it's better, but in other words, the page that we're trying to be on, which is the first substantive page, is not coming up. Shall I? Yeah, I think everyone's got the...
There we are.
Okay. So, expropriation is recognized as an essential mechanism for the state. For the state to acquire property in certain instances, such as essential infrastructure, land reform, and conservation, and is thus protected by the Constitution of 1996. The general framework for expropriation is outlined in Section 25, the Property Laws of the Bill of Rights of the Constitution, which provides that property may be expropriated only in terms of law of general application. That's what we're trying to do. And that no law may prevent arbitrary deprivation of property. The Constitution further determines that expropriation may only occur for a public purpose or in the public interest, and subject to payment of compensation. Okay, so let's just stop there, you see. Public purpose or in the public interest. Public purpose is the common reason why governments around the world expropriate. To build a dam, to put in electricity transmission lines, to widen the roads, build a airport, and so forth. But what our Constitution has introduced is also the notion of public interest. And it defines public interest, I think later we should talk to that, but maybe not. Defines public interest, and give an example of public interest, a case of expropriation for public interest, land reform, for the purpose of land reform. But it says that's not the exclusive definition of a public interest, but it's one of them. And generally in the property law, it says that the government is not mine, what we think about, but is obliged to move within reason. To ensure that there is equitable access for all South Africans to all the natural resources of South Africa. So that's an obligation. And I was just talking about the legacy of the past and the huge distortions that have been created by that legacy. And therefore there's an obligation of government, and it doesn't matter if it's the ANC or the A government, obligation to move forward within reason, ensuring that there is much more equitable access to the resources of our country. So that would be public interest, okay, and not just public purpose. Okay. I jumped to the last bullet point here. Public interest in good nations, commitment to land reform, reform to bring about equitable access to all South Africa's natural resources, and other reforms to redress the results of past racial discrimination laws of access. Okay. So that's a constitutional obligation. On all of us. Okay, so now the reason for review of the existing Expropriation Act, which is the 1975 Act, that Act confers the power to expropriate the property for public purposes, obviously this is about public interest, on the Minister of Public Works, and generally sets up procedures to be followed by an expropriating authority when carrying out an expropriation. Okay, so then and till now, it's not just the Minister of Public Works that is expropriating authority, as I explained, the whole range of expropriating authorities. But the 1975 Act was basically the Department of Public Works Act, but which also then set up a general approach for all expropriation. However, it had numbers of unconstitutional shortcomings. In particular, it's out of line with the Equality Clause, which is Section 9 of the Bill of Rights, the Property Clause, Section 25, Just and Administrative Action, Section 33, as well as the extension of purpose for expropriation to, as we've just said, public interest. Okay, so none of those respects, we can't rely on the 1975 Act. It's no longer in line with expropriation, which is why there's been uncertainty in government often about how to, in a constitutional, in-governed way to proceed with expropriation. It also, the 1975 Act limits the payment of compensation to owners, to holders of registered rights, and to holders of only certain unregistered rights in expropriated property, leaving out many South Africans who have unregistered rights to property, but who now, in terms of our new constitution, must be compensated if they're appropriated. Section 25 of the Constitution, however, permits the expropriation of property subject to the payment of just and equitable compensation for all persons affected by an expropriation. The Constitution, therefore, extends its protection to both holders of registered as well as all unregistered rights to property. A holder of a right to property, whether registered or unregistered, is constitutionally entitled to compensation when his or her property is expropriated. Okay, turning the page. Compensation in terms of the Expropriation Act of 1975 is also determined primarily on the basis of market value of the expropriated property. And what is very interesting, because there's often a very confused debate in the public around what does the Constitution, our 1996 Constitution, say about compensation. It says compensation must be paid in cases of expropriation. However, it requires that compensation should be just and equitable, and that such compensation be determined by having regard to all relevant circumstances, not just market value. without placing undue weight on any single particular factor. And we quote things directly from the Bill of Rights. It says, the amount of the compensation and the time and manner of payment must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of those affected having regard to all relevant circumstances, including the current use of the property, capacity, landlord, not using the property, maybe would be a factor, the history of the acquisition and the history of the use of the property. That is an interesting question in the South African reality. How does this property get acquired? Through group areas removal, the first bought it dirt cheap as a result of forced removals and so on. Those things should weigh. The market value of the property is, that should not be excluded. Notice not A in the list, it's just one of several in the list. B, the extent of direct state invested in subsidy and acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property. We know that historically a racial minority benefited from massive government subsidies and other actions in order to acquire property and in order to sustain it. And that was public money that went to a minority. Therefore, that also needs to be made up as a factor. And then, of course, the purpose of expropriation. The state, the expropriation authority, there must be good reasons for expropriation. And the compensation needs to also reflect that issue as well. Let's just, on this matter, say that just and equitable means that in many cases you might pay more than the market value. Because it's not just rich landowners, to use that example, who might get expropriated. When you build a dam or an airport, you might need to expropriate a poor community. And the value of their property might be very little. But in order to restart the lives, move on, have sustainable livelihoods in another location and so on, simple market value might not be adequate to assist that endeavor, and therefore we need to be just and equitable in approaching. So we're not saying that it's all, you know, by introducing a whole lot of other factors, the property court is trying to ensure that we get the land for less than market value. We need to apply just and equitable approach. The awesome thing is, you look at the preamble to A, B, C, and E, what you're quoting, it says that we must achieve an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of those affected. And it also relates to the amount that's paid. So there are cases, let's not forget that if the Minister of Land Reform needs to expropriate, it's not the Minister of Land Reform money that pays the compensation, it's public money. And therefore, in the public interest that there's not overexpenditure. And there have been cases, which I won't mention by name, but in land for, particularly in land restitution, we ignore certain amounts of money have been paid because of an awkwardness around using expropriation and not being confident about the need to be just and equitable, yes, not to be arbitrary, but at the same time, governments must represent the public interest, including, you know, how much compensation is paid. And that is, you know, huge, exorbitant amount of paid. It's unjust and inequitable in the public interest. So I think all of those factors need to be borne in mind in the reality of South Africa. Okay, moving on. The Expropriation Act of 1975 doesn't also embody the constitutional principles of just and administrative action. Remember that in line with the Constitution, we also have an act, the Administrative Justice, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Okay, which flows from the Constitution. And therefore, any administrative act by government must be protected and is vulnerable to an argument that you've not met the test of administrative justice. And that needs to apply to many things, but also to expropriation. So you need to show not just that you pay just and equitable compensation, but you also need to show that the process through which you ran was the least effective of administrative justice. And in many senses, that is critical to this bill, because this bill is fundamentally about describing an administrative process that needs to be followed by any programming authority. The city of Cape Town needs to follow this. Mangaung, whatever, needs to follow this, the certainty that we're trying to provide. Okay. So it fails to, for instance, speak about providing for the old act, providing for notification through publication of an intended expropriation, incorporating the purpose and rationale of such expropriation. We now have cases where people have virtually, you know, expropriated a person have virtually not been properly informed. Never mind unregistered bank copies, people with unregistered bank copies and so on, just find themselves arbitrarily interested parties and so forth. The Act doesn't provide for such notification ahead of time. It doesn't provide for the notification not just to those that will be directly affected, but those who will be indirectly affected by an intended expropriation. Property value might go down, or they may go up, like all those fancy buildings in San Francisco, Altrin. Suddenly the property owners are second investment, now their property is worth 5 or 6 times more than they were before South Train was put in. But you need to inform those who are also affected first. Affording interested parties an opportunity to make objections and make representations to the expropriating authority before divisions of expropriation are taken, and requiring the expropriating authority to consider all submissions from interested parties before deciding whether or not to proceed with an expropriation. And we'll see how in the bill we try to provide for all of those things, so that there's a fair engagement and expropriating authority must be able to show that they have taken into account in objections or concerns that are raised. Okay, then, I've already covered this, but let me just do it again. There is an array of authorities currently within all spheres of government that are entitled to expropriate property through various pieces of legislation. At the national government level, the president and various ministers, I think it's about 6 or 7, so I can't add in terms of 50 pieces of legislation, have expropriating powers. Provincial governments, all the premiers have expropriating powers, and various MECs also, various different provinces, have expropriating powers, and all municipal councils are also so empowered. Such legislation prescribes varying procedures for expropriation. There is therefore a need to provide certainty to those involved in an expropriation, both for the state as well as any person affected by an expropriation. The expropriation bill then seeks to ensure consistency across government with the Constitution and uniformity of procedure of all expropriations without interfering with the powers of expropriating authorities. So we're not saying, we're not trying to seek through in the bill the existing powers that the Premier of the Western Cape has. Let's use that example, and I'm not speaking on any particular political topic, I'm just making a point. We don't want to infringe on those powers, or the Minister of Land Reform powers in terms of this thing, but what we do want to do is describe a general approach that must be followed to meet the best of constitution. Okay. In 2013, a draft expropriation bill was published for public comment. Extensive submissions were received from organized agriculture, commerce and industry, the financial sector, the legal fraternity, the property industry, professional associations, public entities, government departments, and members of the public. You can hear why it was a relatively prolonged process, but it is to really make sure that we are providing clarity about our intention, and listening also to often the professional and expert advice of people from the banking industry, for instance, or from ABSA and so on, understanding, get a better understanding of their particular concerns and of legitimate concerns. In the main, as we say, the comments were positive and offered a wide range of proposals towards improving the draft legislation, and we certainly try to do that. The revised expropriation book was thereafter submitted to NEDLAC. A top team concluded its deliberations with relatively few areas of disagreement recorded. There were no areas of disagreement where labour, community and business unanimously opposed any provision of the draft bill. And so NEDLAC adopted the top team's report in 2014. The expropriation bill before 2015 was introduced in Parliament and referred to the Portfolio Committee of Public Works. February 2015 was published for public comment. Portfolio Committee hosted public hearings, extensive ones, between May and June of 2015. Following extensive deliberations, the committee adopted a revised bill on the 2nd of February 2016, and then last Tuesday, the National Assembly adopted the revised expropriation bill B4B 2015, which is what is before this committee. Okay, now we're going to the meat of it. Clauses 1 and 2 contain definitions and deal, like most bills, and deal with the application of proposed legislation determining that an expropriating authority may not expropriate property arbitrarily or for a purpose other than a public purpose or in the public interest. The expropriating authority is obliged to enter into negotiations with the owner of property required for such purposes and attempt to reach an agreement on the acquisition of the property before resorting to expropriation. So we're not abolishing the idea of willing seller, willing buyer. That's a bit of a root. If you're a willing seller and willing buyer, it's pointless going for an expropriation. But where there's for any number of reasons is not a willing seller, willing buyer, but there's a pressing public interest or public service need, then a process of expropriation may kick in. Okay. Okay. The in brackets we are saying, we'll come to that later in the bill, but there are cases, and internationally, basically, there's also provision made in legislation to ensure that you might need to expropriate for an urgent basis, times of warfare, natural disaster, and so there might be a need to acquire property to address particular issues. But we will come to the urgent basis for substantially as we proceed. And the bill detects that no property, I'm just repeating the point, as we will continuously may be appropriated unless the prescribed procedures in this bill have been followed. Moving on, then Clauses 3 and 4 grant a general power to appropriate. So originally there was some confusion about this. This is not a bill primarily a bill for the Ministry of Public Works, but it is being introduced through the department. And because the legislation that we want to abolish, basically, which is the old 1975 Act, deals specifically with them with the Minister of Public Works powers. So Clauses 3 and 4 do address the powers of the Minister of Public Works and responsibility in regards to expropriation, but it's just in Clauses 3 and 4. There was, in the public debate, there was some confusion because we thought we were giving all expropriation powers uniquely to the Minister of Public Works, and not simply the case. Okay. But Clauses 3 grant a general power to expropriate to the Minister of Public Works. The Minister is empowered to expropriate property A for purposes connected with the execution of his or her mandate. In other words, the Minister of Public Works can't expropriate for land reform purposes. That's the responsibility of another minister. A municipal road or whatever that needs to be built, it's not the Minister of Public Works that would expropriate. We're not trying to, that it needs to be in terms of his or her mandate, or be upon request by an organ of state other than an expropriating that satisfies the minister that it requires particular property for a public purpose or in the public interest. That's there because not all organs of state are expropriating authorities. Not all of them have the power to expropriate. ESCOM would be one example. Currently, the legislation would be need to change, but basically, the ESCOM can't expropriate to put transmission lines or whatever without the expropriation being signed off on by the Minister of Public Works, obviously in engagement with the Minister of Energy. That's too complicated a process, and we hope that the Department of Energy will change their legislation to allow it to go directly to the minister, their minister. Okay, but there might be cases where the Minister of Public Works will take responsibility, provided he or she is satisfied that it's a legitimate case to find a final expropriation. But otherwise, existing expropriating authorities remain expropriating authorities. We're not turning the Minister of Public Works into the king of all expropriations. Okay. So the minister's mandate, which was by the Minister of Public Works, his or her mandate includes the provision and management of the accommodation and infrastructure needs of organs of state. That's clearly what public works is about. Mm-hmm. The minister may delegate or assign his or her powers and duties contained in the bill to an official of the Department of Public Works, except for power to provision. They can't delegate that. Honestly, or luckily, you don't have the power to expropriate. You don't have the power to expropriate urgently or on a temporary basis, or withdraw an expropriation, because sometimes there might be a withdrawal, or make regulations. Those obviously are ministerial powers and can't be delegated, but other functions in the process of expropriating can be delegated. In other words, the minister doesn't have to physically go and inspect the property and so on. Those funds can and obviously need to be done by, can be delegated to officials. Okay. Now, leaving behind public works specifically, that means we're now into the meat of the expropriation bill. Clauses 5 and 6 deal with the pre-expropriation phase and detail various procedures to be followed by an expropriating authority prior to any expropriation. These procedures are used to ascertain the suitability of the property for the purposes for which it is required and to gather information on the existence of registered and unregistered rights in such property and the impact of such rights on the intended use thereof. So in other words, an investigative process needs to be followed, and if there's a challenge like that, they can be in the justice. If this has not been followed, then the expropriation is subject to cancellation, basically, to being classed as unconstitutional, and locked in compliance with this law once it becomes legislated. So you can't wake up on a Monday morning, on a Sunday, you know, and funny Monday morning and decide, right, okay, we're going to build a road over here or a dam over there and we expropriate. Can't do that. You must investigate. And you must also try to the best of your ability to establish who owns the property, and both in terms of registered rights but also unregistered rights. The bill also provides that the expropriation authority may authorize persons to enter the property with a view to surveying and valuation, among other things. Okay. Otherwise, you can't do a proper evaluation. You might enter the property and conducting that might realize actually this is an inappropriate. Instead of putting up a second tower here because it's not in the right place or whatever, you can only find that out by doing the inspection. Provision is also made for a person to claim compensation should the property be damaged as a consequence of the damage. Obviously, if my people trample all over a valuable crop and so on, then the expropriating authority of the thing would be required to compensate. Okay, in gathering information on the property, the expropriating authority is obliged to consult with other organs of state that may be affected by the contemplated expropriation. When contemplating the expropriation of land, not the only thing that can be expropriated, but if it's land, the expropriating authority must consult the Departments of Rural Development and Land Reform, Environmental Affairs, Mineral Resources, and Water Sanitation, as well as any other organ of state whose functions and responsibilities will be clearly affected. The municipality also, where the property is situated, to ascertain the impact of the contemplated expropriation on municipal plans, say IEPs and so on, need to make sure that crossing lines. Clause 7 to 11 deal with the post-investigation phase. That's completed. At this stage, the expropriating authority would have gathered all relevant information and consulted with no parties affected by the contemplated expropriation. Should the expropriating authority intend to proceed, it must serve all affected parties known to him or her with a notice of intention to expropriate. So you'll see there are two notices. The first notice is a notice of intention. This notice will, amongst other things, include the description of the property. This is what we intend to expropriate. The purpose for which the property will be expropriated. Land reform. We need a servitude to put in a electricity power or whatever. See the reason for the expropriation of that particular property. We can't expropriate the servitude on a neighboring farm because let's take the transmission line, the funny direction of the rail line or whatever. That's the reason. A directive to the owner holder of rights to furnish particulars for holders of unregistered rights known to them. So in the investigative stage, the expropriating authority might not be able to uncover who else is living on the farm. Who else might have unregistered rights. Who might be affected by this. And there's an obligation, therefore, on the formal register property owner to also disclose any knowledge that they have of unregistered rights known to them in the property that's affected. The notice, this third notice of intention to expropriate must also call upon the owner or a holder of a right to affect the property to provide a written statement stipulating the amount claimed as just and equitable compensation. Okay. So what is price that what is the compensation that you're requesting? All affected parties are given the opportunity to submit written objections within a stipulated period. Expropriating authority must consider all objections and submissions timely before proceeding with an expropriation. If there's no agreement on the amount of compensation payable, if no agreement can be reached between the expropriating authority and the owner or holder of a right within a specified period, the expropriating authority must take the decision whether or not to expropriate. So this might decide not to proceed, but must make a decision, can't just leave it hanging in the air. Because that's also discriminatory against people who are threatened with expropriation, who put in a compensation claim and then don't hear anything. People in the property value draft, all kinds of things. So we are very careful about indicating timelines that we're talking specifically about this in a flow diagram towards the end of this presentation. Okay. If the appropriate authority then says, right, I do intend, there's no agreement on compensation, but I do intend to express it. Provision is made nonetheless for further negotiation on compensation with the owner or holder of the right. It's not just a take it or leave it, there's a provision for a tooling and fro. Clause 8 then deals with the next notice. Okay, so once a notice of intention has been served and the process has happened, and the tooling and froing, particularly around compensation, but might be about other matters as well, then if the expropriating authority is convinced of the public need received, a notice of expropriation is served. A notice of expropriation must be served on 1. The relevant owner, 2. Holder of a registered right, 3. Known holder of an unregistered right, and all known affected parties. Obviously, when you don't know, and there might be cases where you don't know, you can't make it a legal obligation to be served, but we're really trying to ensure that everyone that's affected, that there's transparency and that we are able to uncover all affected properties. The notice of expropriation must, amongst others, contain a full description of the property, description of the person for which the property is expropriated. Can't say, what is all the transmission lines, and then say, oh, by the way, actually, no, we don't want to say we're going to give you something else. I want to actually give my cousin a farm. C, so you must be clear about what the purpose is. The reason for the expropriation of that particular property and not some other property, the date of expropriation, and the date on which the right of possession of the property will pass to the expropriating authority. So the date of expropriation and the date of actual possession might not be the same thing for a number of reasons. And the amount of compensation offered or agreed to. So it might be agreed, but it might not be agreed. But either way, then finally the notice of expropriation must indicate a final compensation amount. This notice of expropriation must furthermore be accompanied by documents which set out the date of payment of the compensation, indicating the property by way of a survey, diagram, or sketch plan, an explanation of what the offer of compensation comprises of, and together with supporting documents detailing how the offer of compensation was determined. So it's not whimsical, but associated, valuation and so forth, which are provided. Clause 9 then states the effect expropriation has on the property concerned, which includes that ownership of the property vests in the expropriating authority on the date of expropriation, so the vesting happens on the date of expropriation, and that all unregistered rights in the property are simultaneously expropriated, subject to certain exceptions which can be shown. So moving on, a further effect of expropriation is that the expropriating authority must take possession of the property concerned. Until the date of possession, the expropriated owner or expropriated holder of a right to restore in possession of the property must take care and maintain the property. The expropriated owner or expropriated holder of a right must be compensated for costs necessarily incurred for the maintenance of the property. Okay. The limits of considerations that come into that, I mean, for instance, there might be a farmer with a crop which has not yet been harvested, and so there might be a delay in actual taking of possession. So although the expropriation has happened, and the ownership now vests with the expropriating authority, at the same time you allow the continued use of, otherwise it would be unfair it might be situations where that's just in the compensation of state benefit, but there might be other situations where you allow the landowner and the property to continue occupation of the farm. But at the same time there might be other reasons why there's a delay in taking possession. And there's an obligation, obviously, for the expropriator not to run it down deliberately and so forth. But must be compensated for any costs incurred. Clauses 10 and 11 deal with claims made in respect of unregistered rights and property which property had already been expropriated. So there might be post hoc claims. We didn't realize that there were other people involved who now are expropriated. So we need to make allowance for that. The bill recognizes that holder of an unregistered right of property that has been expropriated is entitled to compensation. Provision is made for the submission of evidence to the expropriating authority to verify the claim and for the duties of the expropriating authority in this regard. Clauses 12 to 20 deal with the determination and payment of compensation. Big issue, not easy, but obviously we need to have some edge clauses that deal with this matter. Section 25(3), as we've already said, of the Constitution determines that the amount of compensation and the time and manner of payment must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest on one hand and the interests of those who have been affected by expropriation on the other, having regard to all circumstances, including, so this is not an exclusive list, other factors could also be borne in mind, but the Bill of Rights says include, we 3%. All right, but this is, I think, important, so let me read it again if you don't mind. Current use of the property, history of acquisition and use of the property, going back to how many years, whatever, market value of the property, extent of direct state investment in subsidies, acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property, and the purpose for the expropriation. That's not an exclusive list, done when compensation is determined from those criteria. And if there's a challenge in court, the courts will also need to be guided by that Bill of Rights. Injunction. Those are guidelines which are embodied into the bill, but in any case, they're in the Constitution as well. Clause 12 also deals with factors which must not be taken into account when the amount of compensation is determined. These are the fact that the property has been taken without the consent of the expropriated owner or expropriated seller. Okay. You can't pay what in Afrikaans is called prana geld because the person is very unhappy. Expropriation does sometimes, unfortunately, make people unhappy, okay? You do your best, if a willing seller, willing buyer approach, but if it fails, and it's in the public interest or public purpose proceed, you can't take into account the degree of unhappiness of the property. But you do need to compensate, subtly and equitably. Special suitability of the property for the purposes is required if it is unlikely that it would have been purchased for that purpose in the open market. Any enhancement in the value of the property, if that enhancement is a consequence of the use of property in a manner which is unlawful, okay, that's obvious. Someone has unlawfully, whatever way, increased the value of the property. That can't be one of the calculations that you take into account. Improvements made after the notice of expropriation was served, except where such were agreed on or undertaken in terms of contractual obligation. So, notice of expropriation, not just the intention, but a notice of expropriation. Somebody can't suddenly build a skyscraper on it and claim billions of rand, I think. That's not taken into account. Unless there's been a contractual agreement. Please look after this and that because once we've taken possession as a state, we need to make sure that the river hasn't been diverted or that river's been running or whatever. Anything done with the object of obtaining compensation, therefore, and any enhancement or depreciation in the value of the property directly attributable to the purpose for which it is required by the state. So the state can't say, well, because they announced an expropriation, the value of the property has gone down, therefore we have to, on the day that we take position, the compensation is less. Neither party should take that into account. That's unfair to one way or another. So if it's, you know, if Caltrain wants to expropriate, or if Transfer wants to expropriate, in a particular area, then the value of that property is brought up. Once the notice has been issued, the fact that the value of those properties around the new station has tripled in amount can't be a factor in one compensation for those who've been deprived of property. Okay. So that's my point. Clause 13 makes provision for the payment of interest on any outstanding amount of compensation once the expropriating authority has taken possession. Section 14 deals with certain obligations on owner or holder of a right to receive the notice of expropriation. Owner or holder must within 20 working days of receiving the notice indicate that he or she agrees to or rejects the amount of compensation offered. Okay. So this is offered to and fro and so on. Finally, there's a notice of expropriation. There can't now still be a long deadlock and so on. Once that process has happened properly, then there's a time on a 20-day working day timeline on indicating whether there's an acceptance or rejection of the amount of compensation. If the offer of compensation is rejected, the owner or holder must indicate the amount he or she claims as just and equitable compensation. Provision is made for particulars which the owner or holder must furnish. Provision is also made for the expropriating authority to extend the period of 20 working days if it's a reasonable thing to do, which is indicated in terms of support. Clause 13 provides that if the expropriating authority rejects the amount claimed by an expropriated owner or expropriated holder, the executing authority must, within 20 working days of delivery of the statement coming from the person, the entity being expropriated, containing the amount claimed, make a written offer of just and equitable compensation. So again, there's still time for a little bit of backwards and forwards, but not too much. The offer of compensation, again, from the side of the state, must include all particulars of how the amount is made up and calculated, as well as copies of reports detailing how the offer was determined. 16 then provides that the expropriator of the authority of an expropriated title or expropriated hold of a right made in time to time in writing requests to certain particulars regarding the compensation claim and offers of just and equitable compensation. So you could be going out of our way to ensure that it's not arbitrary, and that there's the, you know, if it's unclear to the expropriated holder how this particular valuation was determined and so on, they have the right to request further particulars. Clause 17 then deals with the payment of the amount of it as compensation. In essence, compensation comes due on the date on which possession of the expropriated property passes to the expropriating authority. It can be paid before, but it cannot be paid in practice except with one exception, later than the taking of possession. So if both people have been flagged on their farm or passed to their farm and so on, then when that deprivation actually happens, no later than that, there must be compensation. Clause 18 deals with instances where expropriated property is subject to a mortgage or a deed of sale. Complicated area, as you can imagine, and an issue that we've engaged the banking council and others quite extensively. Provision is made to whom payment of the amount of compensation must be made. Clause 19 makes provision for the expropriating authority to pay from the compensation money any outstanding municipal property rates and other charges on the property up to the date of possession by the expropriating authority. So if it's outstanding electricity bills, rates and so on, then it's unfair to pass it on to the public, not to the public money. The compensation money for instance, should also then cover those extra costs. Clause 20 makes provision for instances where the expropriating authority may deposit the compensation with the master of the High Court. There can be cases where, for instance, the expropriated property is left in a will to undetermined beneficiaries. And so in that sense, compensation, it's hard to determine who specifically, and so the payment would obviously then be made to the master of the High Court. Clause 21 provides that in the absence of agreement on compensation to the expropriating authority and the expropriated owner or expropriated holder of a right may attempt to settle their dispute by mediation. This was very much something that we introduced in the course of the hearings and discussions in the portfolio committee, to say that if it's just impossibility of reaching an agreement on compensation, obviously there's a right to go to court, but it can be difficult or challenging to go to court. So let's try to introduce also a mediation possibility. So both parties agree to mediation, then we make provision for that to be in it. And that's an important step, we believe, to avoid huge legal costs and time delays and so on, which court cases can result in. The clause further provides that if the parties are unable to settle the dispute by consensus, or if anybody does not agree to mediation, the expropriating authority must refer the matter to a competent court. So we're not saying we expropriate, people are unhappy about the compensation, let them go to court. We're saying in the law that because it can be difficult perhaps for a rural community or whatever to approach a court or to find ways and means to do it, then the expropriating authority has the obligation to at least table the matter before a competent court. The court must determine the dispute between the expropriating authority and the expropriated owner or expropriated holder of a right of property. That provision does not preclude a person from approaching a competent court on any dispute relating to the application of the envisioned outcome. So, although we're saying in a case where there's just lack of agreement on compensation, the obligation for expropriating authority as it were to table the matter in a competent court. But that doesn't prevent, let's say, an expropriated owner from themselves proactively going to court, one on compensation, but on any other matter, and primarily on the matter of administrative justice. Okay, so that's another. So if all of this complicated process, hopefully not too complicated, but just in a critical process that you're describing, if there's a strong sense that an expropriating authority hasn't followed a good ground for feeling that not followed this process, then someone that's expropriated can directly go to court and challenge the expropriation. Okay. Okay, moving on. Clause 22 deals with urgent expropriation. Okay, we really hinted at that. In the case of a disaster, for instance, or for court so orders, an expropriating authority may exercise the right to use property temporarily for a period not exceeding 12 months. the expropriating authority is exempted from certain provisions of the Indemnities Act should it take property temporarily on an urgent basis. And we'll explain what those exemptions might be. The expropriating authority must, within 30 working days of the notice to use the property temporarily, make a written offer of compensation to the owner or holder of a right. Okay, so what I'm saying, it's been a terrible disaster. Government in one form or another, municipality or department or departments need to get in. Normally what happens is that there's willingness on the part of the landowner to allow that to happen. But there are cases sometimes where, despite the fact that it's a terrible disaster, they're reluctant to allow access, in which case an urgent expropriation is permitted, and obviously you can't sort out compensation before doing it. Therefore, but within 30 working days of the notice to use the property temporarily, a written offer of compensation to owner or holder of the right must be made. If property is damaged during the temporary use, not by the aircraft that crashed, but by the expropriating authority in using the property to do something about it, the expropriating authority must repair such damage or compensate the owner or holder of the right for the damage. Okay, then there's withdrawal. It can happen that after expropriation, you might find that for any other reason you want to withdraw that expropriation, that you no longer require the property that's been expropriated. So Clause 23 authorizes an expropriating authority to withdraw an expropriation if the withdrawal is in the public interest or the reason for which the property was expropriated is no longer applicable. Under certain specified instances, an expropriating authority may not withdraw an exemption. If an expropriation is withdrawn, ownership of the property again vests in the owner from whom it was expropriated. The expropriating authority will be liable for all reasonable costs and damages incurred or suffered by the owner as a result of the withdrawal. Okay. So in clauses 24 to 31 deal with the sort of documentation process, basically, and publication of documents and so on. So it's a little bit tedious, but it's important to spell these things out. This again, so there's clarity to all expropriating authorities and to those who might be expropriated. It deals with the delivery and publication of documents, the extension of time allowed for certain action, the register of all expropriations, civil fines and offences, power of the Minister of Public Works to make regulations, impact on existing legislation, repeal of laws, and transitional arrangements. And say, clause 24 deals with the service of documents, the delivery thereof, and publication of expropriation notices and related documentation. This includes the use of radio and television if deemed necessary. Clause 26 requires the Department of Public Works to establish and maintain a register of all expropriations, this register must be accessible to the public. All expropriating authorities will be obliged to provide the department, in order for this department to fulfill that obligation, with copies of all notices of intended expropriations, decisions not to proceed with intended expropriations, and withdrawal of expropriations. So there's a complete record which is publicly accessible. Clause 27 deals with a failure to provide information or documentation as prescribed in the bill for which the civil court may impose a fine. If a municipality fails to provide a national department with appropriate documentation, then there's a possibility of a civil fine. I get that right? Yeah. Obviously also there, and that would be a civil matter. It might be if there's a delay or the municipality has got problems with its records or whatever. There's the possibility of probably one seeks cooperation between different governments. But there need to be consequences if there's been a failure which is problematic. However, in the case of B, where there's a willful or false or misleading information is provided, conviction is possible and will be punishable as if fraud had been committed. So that fundamentally it is fraud if there's a deliberate attempt to, as it were, provide false or misleading information. As far as any existing laws dealing with expropriation are concerned, Clause 29 proposes that those laws must be interpreted consistent with the provisions of the Envisaged Expropriation Act, in other words, with this bill. If there is a conflict, the Envisaged Act will apply. So this will, where there's conflict with other laws that allow for expropriation and so on, the provisions of this bill, once it becomes an act, must prevail. the envisaged act will repeal the Expropriation Act of 1975 and the Laws Amending that Act. Okay. So that's it. And then just, of course, for my own sake as well as for yours, hopefully, it's a process. What we've done is we've also then tried visually, as it were, in a flow diagram to just repeat the steps that we've outlined, just sort of like in a kind of page. So the first fundamental step envisaged in the bill is investigation and evaluation of a property to ascertain the suitability of the identified property for intended purposes and also to establish registered and unregistered rights in such property. If a property is land, there's an obligation to consult with those departments, rural development, environmental affairs, mineral resources, water and sanitation, any other relevant organ of state and municipality where land is situated. Okay. Then the second step is a notice of intention to expropriate. It must be published to inform the public. It must be served to all known affected persons, inviting objections and submissions. And if the property is land, it must also be, this notice of intention to expropriate must also be delivered to Rural Development Land Reform, DEA, DMR, Water and Sanitation, and the affected municipality. Affected persons must lodge objections and submissions within 30 days, working days, or within an extended period if it's granted by the expropriation authority. So we don't want a process that goes from Monday to the next Friday, and that's arbitrary. But at the same time, we don't want a process that takes forever and forever. It's very important to get that balance right, because otherwise government can't implement the mandate to fulfill the public business and public interest. Okay, so to get that balance right. Not easy, but that's what we're trying to achieve. If an expropriating authority, after due consideration of all information that submissions receive, decides to proceed with the expropriation, he or she must cause a notice of expropriation to be served on an owner holder of registered rights, served on all known holders of unregistered rights, and published to all unknown holders of unregistered rights and the broader public. If it is land, a copy of the notice must be delivered then, again to those same departments and relevant organs of the municipality, to the Registrar of Deeds and Mineral and Petroleum Titles Registration Office, and the holder of the mortgage bond registered against property. Okay, so that all the parties affected or potentially affected are aware of this notice of expropriation. This notice must include the purpose of the expropriation, and a reason for expropriation of that particular property, the date of expropriation, and the date of possession of the property. The amount offered as compensation, including compensation offered to known holders of unregistered rights in the property, unknown ones that emerge later, obviously then also need to be compensated, but you can't include them if you don't know them at this point, and an explanation of what the compensation comprises of and how it was determined. Okay. Then we move on to the process in negotiating compensation. Notice of expropriation must include details of an offer of compensation, expropriated owners and holders of rights, and indicate within 20 working days from the date on which the notice of expropriation served whether the offer is accepted. That 20 days may be extended by the expropriating authority if there are reasonable grounds for doing so. If not accepted, if the compensation offered is not accepted, expropriated owners and holders of rights must indicate compensation claims and provide from their side full particulars of such a claim, including valuations or other professional reports informing their counterclaim. If the expropriating authority does not accept the claim by an expropriated owner or holder of rights, he or she must make a revised offer indicating full details thereof. A claim for compensation and an offer of compensation remain in force until the expropriating authority makes a revised offer. A claim or offer has been accepted or compensation has been decided or approved by a court. Okay. Then resolution of disputes through mediation or approval, stroke determination by a court. In the absence of agreement or compensation, the expropriating authority and the expropriated owner or holder may attempt to settle their dispute by mediation. We'd encourage that if possible. If the parties are still unable to settle their dispute by consensus, or if any party did not agree to mediation, the expropriating authority must refer the matter to a competent court. Okay, so it's there with the court, and the expropriating authority must take responsibility to them. The expropriating authority can't, as it would, take a case against itself. So that's not what we're talking about, but it at least provides the information for the court to consider. So if the claimant, the expropriated person or entity there is a court to which they can take their case if they've got a case. The court must determine the dispute between its expropriating authority and the expropriated owner or holder of a right. This provision does not preclude a person from approaching a competent court, as we've already said, on any dispute like administrative justice relating to the application of the Envisaged Expropriation Act. Where a court finds that a provision of the Envisaged Expropriation Act has not been complied with, it must make such an order as it considers just and equitable, having regard to all circumstances. Okay. So in short, and not so short, you know, it's a bit complicated, but hopefully it's a relatively clear process, and we are very, very confident, not just coming out of the Port Valley Committee and National Assembly, that while it might be improved, we are very convinced that it's a constitutionally compliant and constitutionally necessary piece of legislation. That's our attempt to deliver to you many, many years of work. And we look forward to working with the Select Committee and the National Council of Provinces to ensure that we don't delay what has now been, it will take your time, obviously, but we don't delay something that has been required for nearly 20 years by the Bill of Rights. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the members who have listened very patiently for the long term.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister of Public Works, for the update that you have given to us, for the briefing that you provided. We know that there has been many of the support staff and legal minds sitting behind the development, and also to our colleagues in the National Assembly for the work that they have done on the document, which we'll also take into consideration as we look at the just in terms of the process of our members of the Select Committee, we will be receiving the bill today. Then we will have the public hearings on the, we will brief the provinces. Do we look at the same documents? The permanent delegates will brief the provinces on this bill during the week of the 14th to the 18th of March. On the week of the 11th to the 22nd of April, that's actually for 2 weeks, there will be public hearings on this bill convened within the provinces in consultation with and under the leadership of the provincial governments. That's for the week of the 11th to the 22nd. For the 2 weeks, 11th to the 22nd of April. We will then come back as a select committee on the 26th of April to deliberate our negotiation mandates on expropriation. And then we will seek final mandates on the bill when we meet on the 3rd of May. Now we can share these dates with the colleagues in Public Works. I think it has been shared with them already. It has also been shared with all the members of the Select Committee. It's just procedurally that I thought it might be helpful if we again refresh our memories before we go into the next part of our deliberations for today. We have been talking about just and equitable, and we want to give an equitable and just opportunity now to the members of the Select Committee, and may I also add to that the delegates that are here from the provinces. You are allowed, in terms of our rules, to participate in the raising of questions or comments that you wish to make to the Department of Public Works. We are now at that stage of our deliberations where I call upon members of the Select Committee to please indicate to me if there's any questions or comments that they wish to make. I want to see if there's more hands. Okay, we will have Honourable Father. For the sake of our colleagues in the Department of Public Works, it will help. Members are here from the provinces, but they are also representing political parties. So I won't mention the parties, but just the provinces that we are from. Honorable Father is from the biggest province in the country, which is the Northern Cape. Then we have Honorable von Lennon next to him. She is from the province with the most wind in the country, and that's the province of Eastern Cape. Then we will have Honorable Mdebe, who is there with a checked red and white shirt, and he is from the province of the Northwest. Let's have the three hands first, and then we'll see if we have time to accommodate more members. But for the just and equitable element also, can I appeal to members that we do not avoid raising our questions, but that we do so in as short a time as we possibly could, so that we give other members time. So I'm not going to limit you on the number of questions, but I would want to say, let's see if we can raise our questions in 3 minutes. 3 minutes. 4 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to start off to thank the Minister for this Appropriation Act that is in front of us, and that we can look through this. The first thing that just comes up to me is the Minister said that obviously we start with a willing buyer, willing seller type of agreement, which we hope can actually happen. But if not, then it comes to me where we thank the market value. Now, market value is usually driven by one valuator, and in this case, the expropriating authority will do this evaluation. I need to understand this expropriation authority. Are they well equipped and well qualified to give the exact value? Because if it is undervalued, my second problem comes in with this. If I have gone and I asked my financial institution for mortgage bond, for instance, for $10 million for a piece of land, and I've started paying off my bond, and here comes this appropriation authority, and they say, okay, we have now decided that your land is worth $6 million. Because of certain reasons, I don't know how they would evaluate, but it is not market related. Now, I can go to all these courts and everything, as the Minister said to us, and all the specific ways of going about, but the problem still stays that I'm going to have at least a $4 million outstanding with my financial institution. How are we going to go about that? Because it will become a problem, because I took out a bond for $10 million, and all of a sudden I'm only going to be given $6 million. So I don't think that will be a fair trade-off to the person. It will put a lot of financial strain on that person. Thank you. I'll only start with that. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you. Honorable Faber, I'm worse than you. I call the Deputy Minister in the House. It's the Deputy Minister. Honorable von Lennon, it has been noted. Honorable von Lennon.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity. I first of all want to look at the program of the bill and the process that we have to follow in terms of the Section 76 bill. When I look at the document supplied to us this morning by the House Chairperson, the program coincides with the one that you're giving. However, the 14th to the 18th of March is a week in which the only two debates in the NTOP will be taking place. You may say that my province may not perhaps discuss the bill on that particular day, but they, as I say, it's the only two debates coming up in this term. Then, or the remaining, if you understand, I want to make sure that we have do justice to the bill, and that we do not run it concurrently with any other Section 76 bill in a province. In other words, if the DORA has to go through the same process, we mustn't do the same. There must be ample time, and we must make sure that we have proper audiences and popular representation to make submissions in the provinces that we do not fail on our public participation process, because this is a huge issue that must be addressed properly. Then, when it comes to the constitutionality of the bill, I would like to remind this meeting that when we did the minerals bill in the fourth parliament, that was ran through the select committee within 13 days and through the house and through the provinces. Then we also sitting with a bill that we then said was not constitutional and that it did not, it would not make constitutional muster. Now, we've been told that it is constitutional, and we believe it's not. So we must be very careful. Our chairperson said no bill will be rushed to the NCOP where there is the bill and the constitutionality thereof and the credibility of the NCOP is jeopardized. This, our house, will not become a rubber stamp to the NA or to any minister for that matter or department. So, an interesting issue that I would like, that's my third point, because we are going to do this by clause still, if I have it correctly. No, we haven't, because we have not gone through the bill clause by clause. The minister has told us. You told us that you're giving us 3 minutes. So I am kindly requesting another sitting of this committee where we can go through it clause by clause to actually do justice to the credibility of the NCOP. And that's my 3 points to start with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Cunningham. Very helpful. Honourable Tebbe.
Thank you so much, Chair. I want to start off by agreeing and sympathizing with Honourable Foreign that if my recollection serves me well, Honourable Foreign, and the 14th to the 18th is the week set aside for DORA public hearings in provinces. So there might be some sort of a clash in relation to what we have to do as a court. Because of the magnitude of the piece of legislation that you are dealing with, what DORA seeks to do, I think it will only be fair that we perhaps look into the modalities of how can we change that. Chair, the debate minute, I want to believe that we are a country that seeks to drive growth, that seeks to see what is it that we want to see moving forward, and part of it would be how do we then seek to expand infrastructural development. But infrastructural development would require that we have the necessary base for us to be able to do it. And the crux of what the bill is to do is to provide such a base, not in an arbitrary manner devoid of any constitutionality. And I'm very happy that you in the bill, the Badger Act has been covered extensively, that any provision that is devoid of any constitutional ramification, whether it's going to not be valid of no effect in the court of law. And also the recourse has been catered for it. But is there any other way that we can be able to set out our objective of development in infrastructural development without taking this route? Secondly, is there any correlation to what the bill seeks to achieve in relation to the outstanding land and asset register? Would it not be better if we could have concluded rather on the asset register, we know where we are sitting, we can be able to quantify what we have and be able to move forward? Slide 11, in relation to clause 3.3, please clarify them, Jupiter Minister. What do you mean? If you have a road that needs to be built, it's a national road in a province passing through a municipality, which body is responsible to expropriate. Slide 17, in relation to clause 9, you are saying in your presentation that there are going to be exceptions. But what are those exceptions? Page 17?
It's
page 17 related to clause 9. Slide 17 relating to clause 9. The latter part says subject to certain exceptions, but those exceptions are not mentioned here, or maybe I missed them. Then I would want you to please expand on them. Yeah, like I said, I think on the part of the recourse on the aggrieved persons during the expropriation, I think the bill is covering it adequately, and I'm satisfied with that. Thank you, John.
Thank you very, very much. I noticed that other members have had their hands raised. We're safe in terms of time. We still have 45 minutes for Honorable Lauder and an hour for the rest of us. So we will definitely take your hand on what we want with the next round, if you don't mind. Just allowing us for the process to flow. Okay, there's a feeling on your left.
He would like to silence us. Chairperson, I'm just concerned that we're going to duplicate some of the work now, because what the feeling that we really need to go through this tools by tools, and now we're touching on some of it, and we're going to redo that later again. And I'm going to ask, if we're going to come back and go through tools by tools, we give sufficient notice of it, and we put out sufficient time, because this is going to take a very long time to go through all of this in this committee, select committee as well. And I want to concur with the Honourable Linen and the Honourable Table that we do not rush this thing through, that we do the DORA properly and then we follow that up with this one. Even if it needs to take us a little bit longer, but that we do it properly as the end should be.
Can I use the time now to, before I give an opportunity to the department to respond to us, to say that the normal procedure that we follow with these bonds is that we do the clause by clause at the final stages, because you will bring something now, then you go and consult, and it changes, and you bring it back again. So we do that at the final stages, and that is on our program. Help me, the Tuesday, the 3rd of March, we will be doing the clause by clause. Because strategically, we are saying that we have done so in the past, and the experience is that it's a much more helpful process to do that after we have had broad consultations. So today's session was merely, as we called it, a briefing. And we can raise questions, we can clarify the process with them. That's the first one. The second point that I wanted to just talk on is related to the program that we have before us and DORA. What we have on the program is the 14th to the 18th of March. It says permanent delegates to brief the provinces. Now, we know that we are not, at the moment, suitably equipped to do that briefing the provinces. The procedure and the process in the past has been that what happens is the department releases staff to accompany us as we brief the provinces. Because you can't ask the province to have a public hearing unless you briefed the province. So the province will go through the similar briefing as what we have had today. There's no decisions taken in for us like that. It's just to say, this is what is before us. That briefing happens on the week to the 14th and 18th of March, and then the public hearings will be conducted by the province, as I said earlier on, and that will be over the two-week period of the 11th to the 22nd of April. If, however, the members feel that strongly that we should not have that week of the 14th, 18th March to brief provinces, we need to say to you that what we have to do through our secretary is to communicate to the provinces that this is our program and request the provinces to indicate to us whether it fits into their provincial programs. And thus far, we've had no province telling us that there's a problem with their provincial programs. But we will monitor that closely, and we would say, you can lobby your provinces if you want to have the date changed, use it so that the province gives us a date. For us, who are your servants in this, what was important is that we don't come to you to give you a wish list. We come to you to tell you that this is what we have already done. And it was a arduous consultation process that we also had to bring in the chair of chairs and get the approval of the chair of chairs, Honorable Nyambi, to help us to say that when he looks at, because we don't sit in the program committee as chairpersons, there's work sitting. So they looked at it there and they said, no, it's fine. You can proceed with it. However, this does not say that that is cast in a mold. If there's strong positions coming from the members of the select committee here, that we must revisit that, let's discuss that towards the conclusion of our meeting so that we can then get a mandate from you as to how we proceed with at least the briefing to the provinces. Because I get the sense that that is the only aspect of our program. I hear you, Honourable Van Lillen, when you talk about not rushing the bill. And if we look at the time that we're giving ourselves, we are now the first day in March, and we're giving ourselves the whole month of April. We did not say when we are presenting this in the NCOP for a final decision, because we will, on that day, the 3rd of May, get our final mandates. Right? And then only after the 3rd of May, we would take it for a final decision in the NCOP. So I think we've given ourselves March, April, and a big part of May, which is 2.5 months. Honourable Van Lillen, I see that you're still itching to say something. Let's have you. I don't want us to spend too much time on the process, Honourable Members, but let's concentrate on the briefing.
Yes, but this is just a few things. You have just...
Sorry, sir. You've just admitted that we're not equipped to go and present to our provinces. We cannot possibly ask all the questions for clarity that we need to ask. If you say the department must go and present on our behalf in the provinces, you take away our rights as permanent delegates of our provinces. We must have, please, I beg you, have the opportunity to have a proper clause-by-clause discussion to equip ourselves properly to be able to understand and present this bill. There are many questions that we have to ask. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, I just want to add to you, said that none of the provinces have indicated that they are not, there were problems in their programs, but how many provinces did respond, and who are those provinces that they didn't have a problem?
Okay. Honourable Taylor?
Not yet. Honourable Van Lingen is raising now a different issue from what I have put it earlier on. My issue is exactly what you explained now, and I follow the logic, and I have spoken with my chair responsible for that committee in the province. So we agree that you are in order. The clause by clause will be taken thereafter as we inflate in our provincial mandate as we come in. And I think members are empowered. And the conventional way of doing this is that you are always empowered with the capacity of the department to infuse in the necessary capacity as we go and please. Members are at liberty at all material times to seek better clarity wherever they can for them to be able to present in processes. But we are ready very soon.
Thank you very much. Let me rule on that. My rule will be, if there's any member that have particular questions related to the bill, we will request you, Deputy Minister, to make your staff available so that that briefing can be done to the individual members. We appreciate that we will, when we brief the provinces, being able to raise additional questions as well. We appreciate as well, Honourable Fundingen, that it would be a richer conversation if we follow the conventional method and have the clause-by-clause discussion in the select committee on the date specified in the program. That does not mean that we want to deprive members of having a full understanding of it. That we will facilitate, and I saw the Deputy Minister shaking his head that he is prepared to make that. Sorry. What's the difference between this and that? The heads to say. Honourable Van Dengen, are you okay that we leave it at that for now?
Chairperson, so what you are saying is that we are being granted another meeting with the department exclusively for us for clarity and informing us clause by clause of what is the situation, but it's only for certain persons that would like to come. And who will organize that for us? Are we doing it through you and the secretary? And by when can we schedule that if that is the case?
I would request that members that are so interested, please give their names to the Secretary Grace. She will then have to liaise with the department to see when they would be able to accommodate us. But it won't be the normal formal meeting of the select committee. It will be a separate briefing that they can provide for us, for the interested parties. Thank you very much. Honourable Lund, can I just say that on your question about the feedback from the provinces, we have already two provinces here. I have had feedback from Gauteng. What has happened is that Honourable Chimunya told me that he had feedback from Mpumalanga. So we have been lobbying our provinces all the time. We also have a clear indication from the province in the Northern Cape that they are prepared to proceed with it through consultations that we have had when the Premier was here for the State of the Province address. However, I would give an opportunity to the Secretary to give us an indication whether she has received any formal response from any other provinces here.
Thank you, Sir President. At the moment, I have not received any formal responses, and we don't normally receive formal responses from the province when we situated the program.
Chair, how can you work on informal communication? After you send out, this is what the need is, communicate back to us, can you do it formally? So thus far there's no province that has given formal response. Now that is what you also need to do to see if it will fit in with the provinces. Not say no, it's some kind of informal communication. See if they can fit it in and let them communicate that back to you in writing so that we are certain that there won't be any offer to be fulfilled.
Okay. I'm not going to allow the discussion on that. I will allow you, member from the state, but to say that we hear you, Honourable Long, we will request the provinces to formalise it. And let us not forget that we are here representing those provinces. So the negotiations with the provinces are not necessarily informal. It's just that the procedure that we have followed may create that impression. So we will ask the provinces to formalise that with us. And as chairperson, I will handle that. It's not the secretary that deals with that. Please,
sorry, members, from this date, I think that there are any problems those days that the interview gives to us or proposed to us as legislation.
Thank you very much. They don't. It is still the same thing, but I've closed the debate, I've made a ruling on the matter. Can we leave it at that, please?
Yes, and I need to also just say that my province in Northern Cape, not in one instance, came back to me on this. So I have no confirmation from my province that they are okay with it or not. And I am the representative of the province in the committee. So till today, I have no feedback from them on this, that this actually suits them. The second point I would just like to make, if the minister gives us someone to go through us with, I would like to be one of these members that go through this clause by clause. There are legal difficulties, and I want to know, will the state advocate also be given to us
to discuss this with us, because I really believe that there are some legal terms that that we have to look at. And I want to know if that will also be, if he will be available for us.
Now, I can speak on behalf of the state advocates and the state legal advisors. They are in the meeting, so we'll give them an opportunity to respond for the time.
Morning, Chair Person. I'm the parliamentary legal advisor, and the state law advisor is not present in the meeting, but I will be communicating with him in respect of what's necessary, and if need be and we require to assist, we will avail ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we then proceed and hand back to the Deputy Minister in the Department of Public Works? There has been, in terms of my calculation, something like 6 questions, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and also thanks to those members who are not listening but who asked questions. First of all, I think some of the questions were directed to the process, and let me just make the obvious point that it's your process, not ours, and we respect that process. And we do need to make sure that, that's an effective process, because one of the challenges to the constitutionality of the bill, when it becomes an act, would not be around the content of the bill, but also the process that has been followed in the National Assembly and in the NPP. So we obviously want to move as quickly as possible, but at the same time, we, you know, it's your process, and it does need to make sure that it's an effective process. And we don't, we are here, and we take the NCOP seriously. We have precisely because we don't want you to rubber stamp it. We've been constitutional for you to rubber stamp the process. So I don't want to get into the process, your program, that's in your hands. But the specific issues that then were related to the Honourable Father asked a question, which had come up quite frequently around mortgage bonds in the case of expropriation and so on. And basically you were asking several related questions. The first aspect is you're saying, what is the competence of valuation in the state? Okay, so it will be a competent valuation. I heard you saying that. Well, let's remind ourselves that first and foremost, the possibility for valuation is not just a one-sided dimension. The property owner who is targeted for expropriation also is required, if the compensation that is offered is not acceptable, is required to provide professional reasons and so forth for why they are unhappy with the particular valuation, and therefore obviously to call upon a valuer basically from their side as well. So it's a pulling and throwing process, and not one in which there's a unilateral valuation made by the expropriating authority, take it or leave it. It's an engagement, and there's, you know, the grounds to query on the part of the targeted expropriatee to say that your valuation was unprofessional or didn't take this into account and so on. So all of those things are provided for in the process, I believe. The second point to remember, and that relates to your 10 million versus the 6 million that you might be offered in a compensation, the two issues there. The first is that, the three issues actually, the first issue is that obviously the compensation offered might constitutionally, and once this is law, legally, be more than the value of the property, depending on the circumstances, and there are various, or might be less. So it's not just market value in terms of the property clause in the Bill of Rights itself. It's not just market value that needs to be taken into account when determining a just and equitable compensation, something all might be less. Okay, so that's the one aspect. So we need always to hold on to that. And for just and equitable reasons, you might be offered 11 million or 6 million on a mortgage bond that you've taken out for 10. So, and I think that's correct. That's true. Secondly, obviously this is also a warning to banks. They need to understand that they can't offer, the loans that they make can't be unsustainable from their own point of view as well. So that needs to be an understanding. That's just on the contrary. I was going to make a simple point to complement what it is. So we've certainly spent a lot of time dealing with banking council and with others and members of the in the National Assembly portfolio that you raised this matter a great deal. And we obviously need to be sensitive to the issue, but at the same time guided by our constitution. And we think that the way in which we formulated it does that. The Honourable Funding said that you have problems with the constitutionality of the bill. We believe that those are not grounded. We've certainly noted that we know that you're not representing a particular political party here, but we noticed that the major opposition party in the National Assembly, in objecting to the particular bill, did not object on the grounds of its constitutionality. Some of the smaller parties, I think, have not been present in the process, they were unconstitutional grounds. So, but we were encouraged, certainly, as government, I'm not talking for another political party, as government, that the major opposition party in the NA would prefer to see some amendments, but did not. But that doesn't prevent you, obviously, or anybody else saying that it's unconstitutional, and let's make sure that we do produce a constitutional bill, which is why I earlier said that let's not delay forever for another 20 years on the one hand, but on the other hand, let's not rush so quickly that the NCOP is not confident that, and certainly I know that the parliamentary law advisor and the state law advisor with whom we work consistently through the process in the NA, I know that they, it shouldn't be the failure. You as the NCOP and as the select committee have every right to insist on their presence and assistance in the process. And we certainly relied on it as well. So let's not rush it, but it's not just dawdle either, please. But it's in your hand, not ours. The Honourable came to ask a couple of questions. They basically said, is our objective not to drive growth? And I would add, drive inclusive and transformational growth. Yes, absolutely. And clearly, infrastructure development is a very important aspect of that. And expropriation can be an important means for ensuring that we're able to put in, I guess, the example earlier of Eskom being delayed forever and ever, and often held to ransom by exorbitant claims. So the state does need to have confidence that for a public purpose like infrastructure build, it does have the ability constitutionally to proceed with expropriation. So, but at the same time, let's not turn this into the silver bullet. Expropriation is, even with land reform, this is, I've been in the public media referred to and picked up on SATV earlier, and the host in the studio said, this land expropriation, but this is a general law of application, not specifically about land, and challenges of land reform are multiple. Hopefully this bill, once it's enacted, will help the process, but it's not the silver bullet itself, all of the challenges around getting proper infrastructure in place, supporting small farmers, restituted landholders and so forth. All of those things are critical and more important than expropriation, but expropriation is not the silver bullet, but important means. The question about the land asset register, certainly from our asset register process at the National Department of Public Works, has made extremely good progress. We're now 98% complete. And also to do with valuation, because also it's not just a question of knowing what it is that the state owns, but also valuing effectively, which we've not done as the National Department of Public Works in the past. And so you've got an extensive property portfolio, but you're not running it in a professional and developmental way. So I agree with you, but at the same time, and effective land and asset register are obviously an important element of effective transformation, including expropriation, but let's not make the one or the other precondition on the other. And then the last point, which was what are the exceptions, and you referred to clause 9, and I immediately consulted my advisors from the department, and they also couldn't remember what the exceptions were, but we now have found them, and so we can refer you to the detail. If you look under clause 9 of the actual bill, and this is about clause by clause, because what we're trying to do today is really sort of familiarization. re-familiarize ourselves for a third time and repeat the thing we remember better. It is quite complicated, but obviously it's a long and complex bill. The process is shouldn't be too complex. So we refer you on page 12 of the bill, clause 9, 1B, talks about declarations, and it basically relates to unregistered rights and in particular circumstances in which unregistered rights might be affected, and those are declarations. So that's the specific detail there. Chairman, we are available, and obviously time is sometimes a difficulty, but certainly personally very committed to assisting the NCOP, not undermining or dictating to the NCOP, but assisting the NCOP process. But in my absence, certainly I've got a very competent staff who have been busy with it for many, many years, not least in the case of Andre Marek, Chief Director. So we are very committed to being of help and to hearing the issues and concerns of the Select Committee. So thank you very much for the opportunity this morning to give a familiarization brief, which wasn't that brief, but an attempt to at least familiarize us.
Thank you, Deputy Minister, but we're not finished yet. I wanted to just hear from Honorable Tale, do you have a question that you wish to raise to the Department of Public Works?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I was covered by Honorable Ntebe, even though I would want to know how they market the value which was established. And the other thing, I really want to congratulate the department and also request the member that we should really try and move on very fast, even though I know others will agree with me, because if you check on page 12, clause number 18, the bill provides that expropriating authority may authorize persons to enter a property with a view to surveying evaluation, amongst other things. As we speak now, people they don't even have the right to go and visit their forefathers, graveyards. You see, it's very difficult. So I think this bill will end up helping everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Olumdikale comes from the province of Limpopo, and one can understand how grave the need is in Limpopo to deal with the ownership of land in a justifiable manner. I noticed that our two colleagues who are the delegates from the provinces are silent. I just wanted to check with you. Do you have any questions that you wish to raise before I give other members? Our honorable member from Northwest is okay. Our chair from the Free State, are you okay, sir, madam? They're also okay. Then we can come to you on both of them. Please, you have the floor.
With you, gentlemen, this morning, honorable member. The task team report of 2014, is that available to us to inform ourselves of that? And also, whether the Banking Association made any input, because I'm really worried about this in relation to the Protection of Investment Bill and other pieces of legislation that's going through all at the same time now that could affect our foreign direct investment. And then, you know, to claim land is a very important thing. And when it comes to land claims for public benefit or private ownership, I'm concerned that value determination may not necessarily be in line with what people have in mind, because families that have claimed to farm or their family farms are now in the Department of Public Land Reform. They offered the value of the RDP house, which has happened in my constituency and is of great concern.
And then I want to know what happens if a woman in a traditional area wants to secure her position or shelter or home, what is the situation then? Can she claim to own that piece of land so that she could use it productively and go to the bank for a loan?
Thank you very much. Let's just see if there are any further questions and comments. If not, Honourable Taylor, let's have you as the last line of this matter.
I say that this, the Deputy Minister, left our respect position is more senior. We are not a DG, we are more senior. All of there's a question that you left on slide 11, close 3.4. Let's clarify that when you have, because all three spheres of government are empowered to expropriate. So when you have a national road in a province passing through a municipality, who's responsible? How do you then go about it? And the last one is that I think this is one of the bills where you have, participatory democracy in motion. A lot, we were flooded with the suggestions from public, from business, and we are quite empowered, encouraged by what NEPEC did when the social partners could agree. But this issue that seeks to elevate the issue of land to be more important in this appropriation bill and therefore threatening food security, can you please differentiate on that? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. We will end the question from the members after I added my two. But to just say on the question of that was raised by Honorable Leonard, you see, we have been taught, we are both almost grandparents, that if a child compliments you, you know that there's, if somebody compliments you, you know there's a catch. We have this document which was emailed to us. It's the additional submissions. And all the additional submissions also from the Banking Council are contained in this document. It may not be the detail. I've read the other documents. I just looked at who made the presentations here. I didn't read every word of this document. But if you need more information, I'm sure it can be provided also from the representations that were made by the Banking Council. But then also to say, honourable members, we have another document which our researcher, the researcher of the Contender Advisor, the researcher has prepared this document which we call the Memorandum on the Objects of the Expropriation Bill 2015.
Sir.
Was it part of the package?
Sir.
Yeah, I know there was one of you who said that you just copied what was presented to the National Assembly.
Yeah,
the point, however, that I'm trying to illustrate from now, I'll give you an opportunity, is to say that there has been this document that comes from our support staff that has been made available, and I browsed through it. It is a very helpful document for us engaging responsibly with the Act as well. Let's have you, please.
Okay. Okay. I want to clarify a small thing. Just to say, the document is not my document, as I said in the email. It's a document that I retrieved from the website of the department itself. So it was prepared by the department, that memorandum of object. So it's not my document.
Thank you. Thank you. Your email did say that, I must have said. We know it's very dangerous when you take people's ideas and make it your own. My two questions, Honourable Deputy Minister, would be the one that we do know that we are in a very volatile economic situation at the moment. Would you have a word to the international investors with regards to the impact of this book on property that is owned by international companies? My second question would be related to the Honourable Van Lennep I heard that in. I take offense. I will take it. Well, you can add the individuals, it's fine. It's fine. Yeah, you can add the individuals that can help. Mine is, when we look at historical sites, I have been at a site over the weekend, which is an old slave house, at present sitting on private property. And my fear is, Deputy Minister, that that house may be demolished. And as I was walking through this house, it was painful to think back on how are we actually expecting these people who have had such terrible experiences in this country that last so much. But there may be other cultural heritage sites as well. It would help us to just know, as we engage with our colleagues in the provinces as well, to what extent this appropriation bill is accommodating these type of structures. My second question was actually related to the thing that we discussed in April last year. So I have a third one, Deputy Minister. When we visited as a select committee the Eastern Cape last year, and I can quote it for any other city that we visit in this country, you find that there are a lot of buildings that are just standing empty and they're being vandalized, and the vulnerable people in our society are being abused in those buildings. Now, I know it's more related to the asset rights, but for us as a select committee, when we were in the Eastern Cape, we were saying that we can't have this continuing. What space would the appropriation bill allow for us to be able to deal with these types of vacant buildings in our cities? Thank you, Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Colleague, for the probing and moving question, actually, as well. The apologies about the road issue, because I'm on the other side of a page and I forgot who we did. Basically, the question was, if it's a national road, but which obviously travels through the municipality, and there needs to be perhaps further building of the road or first expropriation to widen it or make it more safe or whatever, then fundamentally for a national road, it would be the National Minister of Transport would be the expropriating authority in this case, but with the obligation, as we've indicated, to, amongst other things, to engage with the relevant municipality. But we would still have an override responsibility for, you know, in other words, municipalities can block it. Interestingly, there are also cases, expropriation between different states, and we always imagine that it's the state that expropriates private entities, but there are cases in which one arm of the state expropriates another arm of the state, and not because it has anything to do with political parties that might be in control, but sometimes it's a reluctance by a national department to release something that is required by a municipality like province. And so, again, this act, once it becomes an act, would also govern that relationship. Hopefully it doesn't come to that, but there are occasions where it could and must, so it's not just private individuals. The Honourable Dihali, I think, raises a very moving issue, which is, you know, that millions of South Africans are deprived from being able to visit grave sites because of their ancestors. And we know that in African culture, grave sites are extremely important. Now, obviously, we're not specifically busy with that, although you then also later on, Chairperson, referred to other heritage-type sites. So this expropriation bill is not specifically related to that, and obviously the particular clause you're referring to is to enable an expropriating authority. Remember that in the bill, we're obliging an expropriating authority before expropriating to carry out a
on site, basically an investigation of the property to make sure that their understanding of the property is correct, that it's the appropriate site for doing whatever they want to do and so on. And we know that just as the experience that you refer to sometimes occurs, sometimes property owners refuse access, and which would prevent the expropriating authority from doing what is required in the clause. So we need, we've accommodated, we've created a clause in the section of the bill which gives them the power to enter properties for the purpose. The Honourable Van Lingen raised questions about the task team, that would be the NEDLAC report, and if it hasn't, if it's not included in your documentation, we certainly will make that available. I think it's a useful reference point. As for banking councils and so on, those presentations were made to the National Assembly Portfolio Committee in the public hearings process. They're not secret documents, so if you're interested, we can make them available. But you also have every ability, if you want, in your provinces or wherever you have public hearings, to call whomsoever you want to make presentations as well. I mean, that would be part of the process. So, but we're not keeping under lock and key any of the presentations, and they were made publicly as well. So there's also a parliamentary record of presentations made by Kassar to the Thomas Mankara Foundation, and the Banking Council of South Africa, and ASA, and many others. The land, I think that's the Honourable Funding as well. I'll come to the Protection and Investment Bill and investors, both private as well as foreign and so on in a moment. You mentioned the case where was it an appropriation in which the value of an RDP house was offered? The land claim.
But I have
put it to
the
yeah.
Land.
I
think when we went on oversight to KZN, there was a section of traditional land where there was a school built on the land. So now there's an issue between the Department of Education and the traditional leaders. The traditional leaders said, yes, you can build a school, thinking there would be compensation. Now there's no compensation, and the school, and it's a huge dispute in the court. It's come a long way. It's in the Maritzburg. So that's another issue that one might look at. But the other one that I was thinking of is a land claim in Koha, where they are now offered an RDP house or 90,000 to build an RDP house.
They might be effective expropriations, but have not been conducted as expropriations. So schools, with a position of traditional leaders, okay. And the if I understand you correctly, the impact of that happening was that someone lost some land, which is and value. I think we're entering into the detail, which is not the purpose of this bill. If those people can show that it's an expropriation, then it was clearly, and there was no compensation whatsoever, then I would imagine that there's a court case. But of course, this act is not in place yet. Otherwise, they might have leverage in the process, but in the absence of it. And that's why it's important to not rush so fast that we, in the NCOP, but it also, we've really got to provide a degree of certainty about these things, because there's a lack of clarity on these critical matters. So I can't answer in detail, because that's not the space that we're dealing with specifically. In terms of your question, which also then related to one of the chair's questions, was, is obviously political debate and public debate around the Protection of Investment Bill. And sometimes, not always, sometimes this bill, this piece of legislation also attached to it, and the accusation is we're fighting more foreign investors at a time when the economy obviously is in a difficult predicament. And the answer, and we're pretty confident giving this answer because we've interacted, I mean, for instance, I've interacted over several days with the American Chamber of Commerce around this piece of proposed legislation. And as the Honourable Member knows, American Chamber of Commerce is not necessarily my most automatic friend, okay? They would reassure by what we're doing here, because what we're doing is we're providing certainty to the courts that often have to adjudicate on cases of expropriation with constitutional guidance, but without clear legislative guidance and detailed guidance. So has there been a fair, administratively just process or not? This gives the courts guidance as to how to make a judgment in that respect. It says to potential foreign investors that they must respect our constitution and not some international laws and whatever. It's our constitution, sovereign, democratic constitution. But there will not be willful and arbitrary deprivation of property. Otherwise, we have a constitution and we will not be respected. So we are to confidence. And our engagements are complete for AgriSA, the representative was present, so that's the now, but who's been following the process very closely. They would like to see changes here from their particular perspective, their own property defined more clearly and so on. But fundamentally, overwhelmingly, what they're saying to, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting the position, they are also relieved that what we're doing is bedding down certainty about how expropriation should proceed, and that we are not allowing arbitrary deprivation, land grabs, expropriation without compensation, which is the human right from certain courts and so on. We are wanting to be meticulous. So we think that rather than frightening off foreign investors, and we need them, that we are providing certainty and clarity, but also within the framework of our sovereign constitutional perspective of South African. So we are committed to land reform, and we can't run away from that. We are obliged by the Constitution to address the inequities of the past, but let us do so in a constitutional, law governed, predictable manner. And we think that that provides confidence to all concerned. We might feel, like property to be defined only as land. That's one of the arguments that we've had and so on. But that isn't how the Constitutional Court has said property should be defined. We shouldn't try to define property and so forth. The issue about food security and so forth, again, that's not really the Home of Public Works or particular act issue. Obviously, we do need, we know it's land grabs in countries not very far from South Africa have resulted in significant food insecurity and many other problems, notwithstanding the fact that there's been a horrible settler colonial history to possession. So, but there, the authorities, which would be rural development, agriculture and so on, need to balance the land reform, the imperative of land reform, land restitution, with also the critical question for food security, and to find, again, a just and critical balance between them. But this expropriation act does nothing to compromise the effort to try to find that. But the details of it would be in the hand. Historical sites like slave quarters are also the citizen, and I think it's so important that we preserve a memory of these things. Whenever I go to Furchester State, I also visit the underground cells, basically, in that wonderful historical building. And they're often forgotten and neglected that there were human beings living in those conditions in Watchers. Obviously, how historic heritage sites and so on, or forgotten things that are really heritage sites, handle is important. And again, that's more in the province of the horticulture department. But if you expropriate it, say something in order to preserve it, then obviously it comes onto the budget of a department. It might be a provincial department, or so. I mean, there would have to be those sustainability issues. But again, nothing would prevent, because that would be in a public interest for a public purpose, public interest in particular, preserving heritage and not losing it. I would imagine we certainly qualify as a public interest or public purpose objective, and therefore, if there was recalcitrance or refusal to assist from the owner or from the person on whom the property is, then expropriation would certainly, in my amateur legal opinion, be more than justified. Lots of vandalized buildings, and eventually the Eastern Cape, not just in the Eastern Cape. I wasn't sure. Some of those buildings would be private buildings. I mean, if you look at St. Joseph, there's a big problem was the blocks of flats which have been just illegally occupied, they become hugely problematic and so on. And again, it would be a decision that would need to be made by the metro, but because again, taking over ownership through expropriation would come with responsibilities and complications. But again, firstly, in my view, once this becomes an act, it would enable the metro, the city of Joburg in that case, to expropriate in order to provide safe, affordable accommodation but that would be a policy call made by the relevant authority, in this case the city of Joburg. In the Eastern Cape, I'm not sure if some of our buildings, what the Department of Public Works are, not being well looked after, have been vandalized, have been stolen in some cases. And that's why, as you earlier said, it's not so much the act that we're dealing with, the legislation we're dealing with, but getting our asset register, getting valuation, and then through the property management trading entity, which we've now set up as a government component within the department, using this property portfolio, not in just a kind of hopeless way, frankly, but in an effective way, you know, with business professionals, but also with a developmental perspective. So we do know that there are many problems with vandalism. I think amateurishly, not just a politician, or economist or any of that. I've got responsibilities, but I'm talking about capacity. I hope I've provisionally answered the question.
Deputy Minister, you've done very well, and we are not saying it because the Minister is here, but because indeed you have. Honourable Van Lingen, I have a problem that I pleaded with Honourable Faber, who needed to leave earlier, that he must stay with us for 5 minutes, because I thought if we have the Minister here on such an important piece of proposed legislation, that it might be helpful to ask the Minister if he can speak to us for 2 minutes. Only 2 minutes, Deputy Minister. Sir Minister. But before, while we're getting you to put your thoughts together, to say, Honourable Members, two things. The one is that this is but just the first session. We have a journey, long journey, on this matter. The good news, however, which we've not shared with you, is that we had a meeting as MENCO with the whole support staff last week, Thursday. And in that meeting, we agreed that both the competent advisors and the researchers would be willing and able to help, but we need to coordinate that. So we're asking you not to communicate with them directly if you need anything, but you communicate with Grace as our secretary, and this applies to both the committees, trade and industrial relations and economic development. And if you need further information, they will be willing to get that information so that we can engage responsibly with the legislation, any piece of legislation, but particularly with this one that is before us now. Don't hesitate to communicate with Chris, and then she will, because we need to have it coordinated somewhere. It's not a control mechanism. It's just to make sure that we have our lines of communication clear. Honourable Minister, can I give you your 2 minutes now?
Thanks, Chair Members. The risking repeating issues which have already been raised and contradiction. Let me just reiterate that there must be no fear. We heard other people talking investment and so on. Every government, as we've said the world over, national or provincial or even the municipalities, they need power to expropriate for development. We must not fear development. Because we need roads, we need dams, we need everything. The current situation is unavoidable when you have to negotiate for a piece of land for more than 3, 4, 5 years. So we want to fast track this thing, but we are also saying we must put proper procedures which everybody has to follow. And I think honorable members must accept that the 1975 expropriation act is outdated. It's updated, it's not in line with the democratic constitution, and can't use that particular legislation. And expropriation is therefore recognized as an essential mechanism for the state to acquire property for various reasons. But to us, we are having a major infrastructure development program, which we have to fast track. It's part of the service delivery. So even those who still want to engage us, we're open for any engagement to explain our values. We'll be ready to do that. But it happens. It happens in other countries. I thought that must have to emphasize that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. Honourable members, I'm not going to look at Honourable Van Lennon because I know she wants to say something, so I'm going to pretend that I didn't see that. Can I just reiterate that we are meeting as the Select Committee on Economic on Trade and International Relations tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And I was trying to confirm with Zupeka, but I see pertaining to the documentation we got from the DTI on the SEFs. So that would be our conversation tomorrow. I need to apologize. I'm in a better mood now than when I got the message from Chris that we do not have the minutes of our last meeting. Because it was finalized late yesterday afternoon. And we thought, let's concentrate on this. So at the next normal meeting of this select committee, with your permission, please, we will present to you the minutes of last week's meeting as well. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the hospital.